Hey, welcome back. Our next speaker this afternoon is Dr. Heidi Graswick, who is from the Philosophy Department at Middlebury College. She is currently editing a volume on feminist epistemology and philosophy of science, so right up the alley of this.
It's out.
Your webpage.
So anyway, that's really
a welcome addition then to the literature. And she will be speaking to us today on epistemic injustice and responsible trust in science. Welcome.
So just to get us started here, I have a couple of images here. I'm not going to talk much about this example, but I'm going to mention it at the beginning and I'm going to mention it at the end because I think it helps show why or how I think my analysis might be able to help us out in some ways. So the image of the polar bear is extremely important in current debates concerning climate change. The Arctic has been identified as an area of early vulnerability for climate change, and the polar bear has become the poster child for the climate change warning movement, as we see here, with people lobbying for changes alongside with their stuffed bears. News stories alert many of us who have never seen a polar bear in the wild, and I bet most of us are in that situation, that their numbers are in decline, with melting sea ice being named as one of the causes. Scientists, and I'm going to call them southern scientists, because although they're often Canadian, U.S., they're not native to the Arctic. Southern scientists have been working hard to establish base numbers and research on any measurable declines in the populations and subpopulations of the bears, while the politicians argue, both domestically and internationally, for upping the status of the threat. The U.S. now has listed polar bears as threatened, while Canada lists them as less seriously as of special concern. And we see the other image here of an Inuit hunter with his polar bear. And the Inuit, of course, the polar bear is very important both for their culture but also for their cash economy with respect to commercial hunts. So this is people who come up and pay very large amounts of money in order to go on a commercial hunt with the Inuit. It's one of their major sources of cash for their economy. So they have a vested interest in both preserving polar bears but also keeping them on a certain status, right, where you can do certain things with them. But, so in spite of the work that's being done by the scientists, news stories also capture the disconnect between Inuit claims concerning the bears and those of the southern scientists. The Inuit insists that the bear numbers are not decreasing, but in fact may even be increasing, citing increased sightings when they're out on the land. Now this whole thing is actually really, really complicated. You've got subpopulations, you've got all kinds of different things going on. But the response of many when they hear these claims of the Inuit is to point out the politics involved, that is the politics on the Inuit side, and the strong interest Inuit have in denying declining bear numbers. Many would criticize them for not being epistemically responsible, for ignoring the clear evidence provided by the scientists. As I said, there's lots of complexity, and my only point in bringing up this example today is to ask ourselves, how can this happen? How can it happen that we end up dismissing certain claims, or how can it happen that we end up with a group of people who are so clearly denying the presumably fairly good work of a southern scientist? And there are answers to how the two pieces fit together, but I'm not going to be able to talk about that today. What I want to ask is whether denying that they're engaged in good knowing or an epistemically responsible inquiry, whether that's the only or the best explanation of what's going on. And I hope that my analysis of the idea of responsible trust in science and also what I will call epistemic trust in justice can help us out here. So I'm not going to talk about that until the very, very end. I think probably most of us are familiar with Fricker's 2007 book, Epistemic Injustice, that placed the idea of epistemic injustice on the conceptual map of social epistemology. Fricker's focus was to offer a detailed analysis of two specific forms of epistemic injustice, testimonial and hermeneutical, arguing that both these injustices are epistemic in form, constituting wrongs done to persons as knowers, that is, knowers in a social world of inquiry. Her analysis of testimonial injustice focuses on everyday transactions between knowers, where because of an identity prejudice, a speaker is given less credibility than she deserves in a testimonial interaction. It has both, as she discussed today, both a transactional and a structural component. Her analysis of hermeneutical injustice is exclusively structural. It's not perpetuated by individuals, but rather by structural systems through which certain required conceptual or hermeneutical resources are missing that prevent a person from understanding and conveying their experiences. In both cases, Fricker identifies ways in which those who suffer social prejudices in their identities can suffer injustices as speakers and contributors to knowledge projects. Importantly, she argues that these are not just distributive forms of justice, where groups aren't given fair access to the knowledge itself. Rather, because she wants to emphasize their core epistemic nature, she argues that they touch more on our core capacities as knowers, including features of our social interaction. So there's something about our epistemic agency that's being denied there. So for her, it's a discriminatory injustice. Since Fricker's book, others have added different forms of epistemic injustice. For example, in educational forms, we still see a lot of focus on distributional injustice, using the phrase epistemic injustice either to refer to inaccessibility to bodies of knowledge or inaccessibility to the tools required for knowledge. And another case, Christy Dotson has argued for the presence of another level of injustice, what she calls contributory injustice, which is where you have a refusal to engage in alternative hermeneutical tools that may be out there in marginalized communities. Now, today I want to argue for yet another form of epistemic injustice that can result in societies where there exists significant social stratification with social marginalization resulting, and I call it epistemic trust injustice. The concept of epistemic trust injustice draws attention to our need to trust others in our knowledge pursuits, a point which I take to be now fairly well established in social epistemology. In contrast to Fricker's two forms, epistemic trust injustice concerns wrongs done to us as recipients of knowledge rather than speakers. Working with a fairly thoroughgoing social epistemology, through which we are richly epistemically dependent on each other, I'm interested in how we engage our epistemic agency as recipients of knowledge and not just as producers or contributors of knowledge. My analysis of epistemic trust injustice depends upon an examination of the conditions of what I'm going to call a responsible trust in others, particularly trust in epistemic communities and institutions, and for my purposes today, scientific communities and institutions. Distinguishing responsible trust from mere trust is a way of trying to epistemically ground that trust. The concept of epistemic trust injustice attends to how such conditions of responsible trust are differentially met depending on a potential truster's social location. Thus, it draws on some of the basic premises of feminist epistemology concerning the situatedness of knowledge and the relevance of social location for understanding what and how we know. So now I'm going to give you the punchline. I'm not very good at jokes. I always give the punchline away too soon, so I don't know if the same holds for papers or not. But here we go. You can go to sleep after this, right? Okay. So what we have here is, in short, epistemic trust injustice occurs when, from the situated perspective of those on the margins, and that is in contrast to those in more privileged social positions, there is an insufficient weight of evidence for the trustworthiness of important knowledge institutions and communities, in part because of the history of social marginalization. This can result in a situation where the epistemically responsible response for those in a marginalized position might be to distrust in those institutions and practices. Those very same institutions and practices, which are our, meaning our layperson's, only source of a wide variety of knowledge significant to us. My interest is specifically in the need for laypersons to trust in the claims and results of scientific communities and institutions, given that scientific forms of knowledge are extremely powerful and important in shaping our lives in the 21st century, carrying both epistemic and cultural capital. And I'm going to often use the phrase scientific institutions and communities, in part because I see communities as crossing over institutions, and sometimes we're not talking about a single particular institution, but there's more that can be done there, but for now I'm just going to be talking about them. Sometimes I might just use one word, but you get the picture. Okay? Scientific institutions and communities are crucial to providing knowledge that matters, and they interact with other powerful institutions of governance that shape human lives. If the presence of epistemic trust injustice makes it less likely that marginalized groups can responsibly trust expert knowledge from science, This is a serious finding, indeed. In order to motivate this concept of epistemic trust in justice, though, I've got quite a bit of work to do, so it'll be a while before I refer back to the concept that I want to illuminate. I need to first articulate the idea of responsible trust and distrust in expert knowers, focusing on the case of scientific communities and institutions. I then need to articulate the conditions relevant to the formation of responsible trust, and I outline a set of interrelated expectations of laypersons that scientific institutions and communities need to fulfill in order to be epistemically trustworthy. And I suggest that responsible trust is connected to the presence of a certain track record or evidence of an institution's fulfillment of those expectations. I then complicate the analysis by introducing concerns about social situatedness, examining how these conditions of responsible trust end up being differentially satisfied in a way that leaves some persons particularly challenged to form trust responsibly. Beginning with trust and trustworthiness, it is not uncommon for social epistemologists to discuss our epistemic dependence on others in terms of trust, and many science studies scholars, along with philosophers, have taken up the specific trust relationship between expert knowers and laypersons. There is such a dramatic cognitive division of labor in modern-day knowledge production that, arguably, understanding the epistemic relationship of trust in experts can be considered paramount to an adequate contemporary epistemology. In spite of our need for trust, however, it should be obvious that trust in others, on epistemic issues and other issues for that matter, is not always a good thing. For trust to be epistemically most helpful for us, it must be present in proportion to the trustworthiness of the source. In the case of science, it's certainly possible to trust unwisely. As someone who suffers technophilia and cannot imagine the scientific community making any mistakes, such a person uncritically sees scientific knowledge as the answer to all problems and believes that any claims that are prefaced with according to science or science has found it, that's what it has to be. On the other hand, one can easily not trust enough, as in a radical conspiracy theorist who, among other things, refuses to believe that there have been manned flights to the moon, and that example comes from Gloria Origi. Neither of these extreme attitudes towards science and its results recommend themselves as epistemically fruitful. If trust in claims provided by institutions of science is to be epistemically grounded, it needs to be taken up in the right degree. And it also needs to be of a certain kind, a kind of trust that is not entirely uncritical, and that can be understood as an epistemically virtuous attitude towards scientific institutions and communities. And this is what I call responsible trust. It's worth noting a distinction between ideal trust and responsible trust. Ideal trust is trust that perfectly balances the degree of trustworthiness of the institutions or communities who are providing the knowledge for one. But of course, as epistemic agents, we cannot usually achieve such an ideal, and much more importantly, we cannot know when we have. So what we need to strive for as epistemic agents is responsibly placed trust in others. The idea of a responsibly based trust suggests that such trust is not completely blind or steadfast. Those are the kind of things that worry epistemologists when they start to think about knowing through trust. Even as trust always makes us vulnerable, insofar as it necessarily extends beyond the evidence for the trustworthiness of the other party. Okay, even given that, it's not completely blind or steadfast. Gloria Origi makes a helpful distinction between two components of the attitude involved in epistemic trust. There is a default trust that we must grant the speaker if communication is at all to succeed. And there's a vigilant trust, which is, quote, the complex of cognitive mechanisms, emotional dispositions, inherited norms, reputational cues, end quote, that we use when we're filtering the information we receive. We use the heuristics of a vigilant trust, but when the stakes are higher, we often take responsibility to check the reliability of our epistemic vigilance. Now, she's actually talking about one-on-one transactions here, but the complexity of how we form and maintain epistemic trust carries over to trust in epistemic institutions and communities also. If we are to trust epistemically, we do not reason directly about the evidence for a claim made by another, but we reason to some degree, and often imprecisely, about the evidence for the trustworthiness of the source. We do not even regularly make those reasons explicit, but we can often produce them when queried. Given the possibilities for such reasoning about the trustworthiness of another, we can make sense of a responsible trust in another as an appropriate source of knowledge and belief. A responsible trust in science is a vigilant trust in which the truster exercises many different critical tools to help filter information, and for which there is some weight of evidence in favor of the trustworthiness of the scientific institution. What kinds of evidence and reasons, then, are relevant to grounding one's trust? My argument is that this evidence is more wide-ranging than one might first think, stemming from the variety of epistemic activities that scientific communities and institutions engage in. Their wide-ranging nature leaves plenty of room for social injustices to bear epistemic relevance. As we shall see, social injustices can lead to epistemic trust injustice. In order to determine what kind of evidence is relevant to developing responsible trust, we must be clear on the scope of one's trust in a scientific institution or community. A trust relation is always one of A trusting B for X, with X being a specified domain. A responsible trust will be one in which A has some weight of evidence for thinking that B is trustworthy with respect to X. But what's the X? In the case of scientific communities and institutions, I think a fair characterization of the trust relationship is that we entrust them with taking on the role of expert knowers. As expert knowers, their primary function, I think, is to serve as providers of significant knowledge. So they're not just producers, they actually are providers. And we trust them for providing knowledge that's significant in the sense of knowledge that matters. Otherwise, we really don't care what they say, right? Of course, they have to produce such expert knowledge in order to be able to provide it to non-experts, but it's important to recognize this key feature of the expert-lay relationship, that the expert provides significant knowledge to the layperson. As such, the institutions serve in a social epistemic role, a role that includes making knowledgeable accessible to others. Now, I don't mean to imply that all the knowledge they produced is made accessible. In fact, that's part of why we rely on experts, so that they don't give us all of it, right? And we don't want all of it, and can't manage all of it. But there are expectations in this role concerning the provision of knowledge that can come with trusting the expert. It's obviously often not the details of their technical knowledge that we wish to have access to when we trust, but rather their judgment. What is my prognosis, given your diagnosis of my condition? What should I do? How serious is the threat of climate change? What mitigation measures are likely to have a good effect? In the expert-lay relationship, it is often this kind of understanding that laypersons expect from scientific experts. The role of an expert, then, requires the provision of knowledge, but it also requires the provision of the right kind of knowledge, that is, knowledge that matters. Using the example of physicists, Stephen Turner notes that the foremost reason people have for trusting experts for whom there is little controversy over their expertise is the efficacy of the knowledge produced. It works for us. There's a connection to the significance here. The efficacy of knowledge ensures that it is in some way significant. When it is obvious that significant knowledge has been produced, we trust the experts. The modifier significant applied to knowledge plays an important role at both the points of production and provision. First, the expectation is that not just any knowledge will be produced, but rather scientific institutions will do a decent job of producing knowledge that is significant or meaningful for us. As Elizabeth Anderson notes, and here's the quote, theoretical inquiry does not just seek any random truth, it seeks answers to questions. What counts as a significant truth is any truth that bears on the answer to the question being posed. Furthermore, Anderson's work clarifies that the question of the production of significant knowledge actually involves two different aspects of significance. Our research must ask significant questions, and it must provide significant answers to those questions. Whereas the demand for significant questions speaks to a research agenda that is well-directed, the demand for significant answers focuses on the need for the answers generated to be meaningful and helpful in providing solutions to the problems that generated the questions in the first place. Sometimes the detailed and systematic research that might come out of a scientific community is not the most helpful for a pressing problem, and more cursory knowledge attempts may generate a more timely and effective solution. This is not a foregone conclusion that trusting scientific experts for our problems is always going to be the way to go. Furthermore, the function of providing significant knowledge also means that in their capacity as experts, scientific institutions and communities need to serve as knowledge filters for laypersons. Laypersons rightfully expect scientific institutions to provide them with knowledge, but not all of it. They're expected to provide laypersons with high-quality results and knowledge that is likely to be significant for them. They need to judge what is significant enough to be conveyed to the various publics and what isn't. A good track record in making these judgments is important for laypersons in order to be able to responsibly trust with their epistemic needs. So if we find out things like the tobacco industry's been hiding information for us that was actually really relevant for us to know, if we were smokers, we'd want to know that it can make you sick, then that bodes not so well for continued trust in that scientific community. The flip side of that is that overwhelming laypersons with every piece of data generated doesn't serve anybody very well, and lots of times it's used in sort of an evil way. I'm reminded of one environmental case a number of years ago. It had to do with Banff National Park, where the pro-development group basically came in with 800 pages of environmental assessment stuff, and the judge said, well, there's 800 pages here, it must be right, and that was the end of it. Yeah, so that part's quite shocking, but the point is that you can actually overwhelm people with just a bunch of stuff that looks very scientific, right? So once we articulate the primary function of a particular trusting relationship, we can grasp a collection of expectations that are appropriately placed on the entrusted. To trust is to have a certain set of expectations that a community, or an institution. And to be trustworthy, that institution must be capable of fulfilling these expectations, or more to the point, likely to fulfill them. From the point of view of the layperson who trusts a scientific institution, for that trust to be responsible, there must be some weight of evidence that the institution can or will make good on these expectations. So now we move to there's a collection of expectations. What those expectations are, what the appropriate expectations are, can be derived from an understanding of the function of the particular trust relation. For example, if I trust you to take on the function of caring for my dog for the weekend, this will presumably carry with it a bundle of expectations, that you will take care of her basic needs, such as the provision of water and food, give her adequate opportunities for her to relieve herself, and that you'll be alert to signs of ill health and take action accordingly, and that you have an understanding of the requirements of keeping her safe and will fulfill those by keeping her on a leash when near roads, keeping house doors closed or noxious substances out of her reach. If I discover that you failed on one of these, I'll likely reassess your trustworthiness the next time I go away for the weekend, right? So when we turn back to the primary epistemic function of scientific institutions and communities as providers of significant knowledge, insofar as they're set in the role of experts, I argue that there's actually a set of interconnected expectations appropriately placed on them by laypersons. Because they're interrelated in the institution's ability to serve in its primary epistemic role, failure to fulfill one of these expectations can affect the overall epistemic trustworthiness of the institution. As providers of significant knowledge, scientific institutions do a lot of different things. They develop carefully crafted research questions, they generate or produce significant knowledge results, they share and communicate knowledge, they act as knowledge filters for the public, they develop technologies that share our lives and health. They recruit and interact with research subjects in order to provide knowledge about humans or particular groups of humans, and oftentimes they advise on policy. Where there is a history or a track record of a scientific institution or community doing well in these activities, providing knowledge that is significant for the public or publics, and living up to the expectations, then laypersons have reason to epistemically trust that institution or community, even though they might fail in the future or fail on a particular account. So the fulfillment of these expectations gives us evidence for their epistemic trustworthiness. If a scientific institution, however, does a poor job selecting significant problems to take up, if it fails to produce knowledge that is significant in addressing our questions or problems, or if it fails to filter the knowledge produced, providing us with the most significant bits, then its epistemic trustworthiness is in question. And for a layperson to be able to exercise responsible trust, there must be a track record or some evidence available to them suggesting that through its various activities, the scientific institution has been able to successfully provide significant knowledge. Shortly, I'll explain how focusing our attention on scientific institutions as providers of significant knowledge help us understand how some of the failings of scientific institutions that have been understood to be social political failings or ethical failings are actually epistemic failings as well in the form of epistemic trust injustice. In this regard, my analysis of epistemic trust injustice shares similarities with Fricker's analysis concerning testimony hermeneutical, trying to pull out the epistemic component of it. Right? Now we have to turn to the issue of situated knowing, though, and how it complicates this overall analysis of responsible trust. I take from a situated approach to knowing found in feminist epistemology the insights, first, that social location can influence both what and how a knower can know in quite a deep way, and second, that all knowledge is situated in the sense of being partial, limited, and perspectival. But one of the challenges of a situated approach to knowing has been to explain how knowers can know well across their material and social divide. The case of epistemic reliance on the institutions of and communities of science is one such case of this challenge. A situated approach to knowing opens the possibility that these institutions may vary in their degree of trustworthiness according to the social location of the truster, and that makes for a more complex analysis. Indeed, Naomi Scheman has made the argument that marginalized groups often have good reason to distrust scientific institutions that they know to be unjust, and that this affects not just the credibility of those institutions, that is, whether in fact they are trusted by people, but also the epistemic trustworthiness of those institutions. Now, she frames her problem in terms of the scientific goal of objectivity, which is a little bit less of my interest today, and she argues that the function of objectivity lies in its ability to ground trust and ground trust across social locations. But I'm actually going to skip a quote from that and keep moving here because I'm more interested in the implications we can draw from this analysis as opposed to specifically on objectivity. So she further argues that because knowers are socially situated, rationally grounded trust may apply to those in some social locations and not others. In particular, she argues that due to a history of marginalization and oppression, there may be circumstances under which it is not rational for a particular group to trust a particular epistemic community and its results. Past research abuses and poor quality science that detrimentally affect certain populations provide reasons for distrust on behalf of the marginalized groups. For example, Steve Epstein cites the history of experimentation on black bodies as a contributor to African Americans' heightened distrust of science. Scheman argues that when there has been a poor history of scientific communities generating knowledge that addresses the real concerns of the marginalized, and when instead there has been a history of exclusion from scientific communities, poor quality research on questions related to the lives of the marginalized, and abuse of the marginalized as research subjects, the marginalized have good reason not to trust the practices and results of science. That is, any of them, not just the ones that have failed them in particular. Emphasizing the epistemic relevance of a history of unjust social relations, Scheman notes, I'm going to skip that one. It is, in short, irrational to expect people to place their trust in the results of practices about which they know little and that emerge from institutions, universities, corporations, and government agencies which they know to be inequitable. I actually think Scheman's language is too strong here, referring to irrational expectations. There's a continuum of appropriateness for one's trust, and there is a complexity to different forms of evidence that might be speaking for or against the trustworthiness or lack of trustworthiness in the institution under discussion. But placing Scheman's position within the framework that I've offered, we can see that she gives support for the claim that the distrust of the marginalized in a scientific institution under these circumstances might best be considered a responsible distrust, matched as it is with the lack of trustworthiness of the scientific institution and the evidence concerning a history of being inequitable and unjust in a variety of ways, got the variety of expectations, that affect the provision of significant knowledge. Scheman's situated approach results in situations where trust in a scientific institution may be the responsible epistemic response from one social position at the same time as distrust may be the responsible epistemic response from one in a marginalized lay position. Let's return to significance then. Up until now, my analysis has stressed the importance of understanding that the goal of scientific institutions is not just the production, but rather the provision of significant knowledge. The situated approach Scheman operates with confronts us with the realization that what constitutes significant knowledge may not be exactly the same across all social locations, and this can introduce complications. Given the situatedness of knowing, all knowers are unlikely to share similar views on the two parts of what constitutes significant questions and significant answers to those questions. Trust in scientific institutions can be well grounded only when there is evidence that there is a pattern of the institutions successfully generating significant answers to significant questions as viewed from the vantage points of particular social locations. But of course, the catch is that if our lives are substantially differentiated, what various groups take to be significant questions may not align. The assessment of how well the institutions of science have done at providing significant answers to significant questions may depend very much on one's social vantage point. Of course, if science takes up lots of different things, it'll hit more people and more different areas of significance, right? One example that's often used is the fact that science has not yet found adequate ways to prevent the spread of malaria, which is one of the most pressing concerns for a significant portion of the world's population. As recent work in the epistemologies of ignorance has noted, analyses of the social and political forces of social production and the production of ignorances reveal that the research agenda of the institutions of science are often geared towards the interests of the powerful and the dominant. Within the framework of the epistemologies of ignorance, areas of ignorance are not viewed as benign gaps in knowledge yet to be filled in, but rather as actively produced and maintained as areas of ignorance. If we examine the maps of knowledge and ignorance, it becomes obvious that we do not all share the same histories with respect to the institutions of science and their relative success in having managed to produce significant answers to significant questions for us, whoever that relevant us is in this case. Where there is a history of a failure to take up questions of significance, distrust in the institution may not only result, but may constitute a responsible distrust. Feminists, for example, have argued that historically, science has done a poor job of taking up and adequately answering questions about women's bodies, largely because of gender relations in society that deem questions of concern to women as less important. These patterns of ignorance give women reason to distrust the research trajectories and current claims of science. Now, none of this should be read as suggesting that all areas of research need to be significant for a particular group in order for scientific institutions to be trustworthy. This is really sort of happening at sort of this macro structural level, right? But where there is a perceived disconnect between the activities and outcomes of scientific inquiry and the kinds of questions and answers a group takes to be significant for them, responsible trust will be difficult, and there is an epistemic loss. Because there are differences in what is considered the provision of significant knowledge and what particularly situated laypersons what particularly situated laypersons need is evidence that a scientific institution is trustworthy in recognizing and providing knowledge that is significant to them. Furthermore, if there exists a history of abuses of one's marginalized group as research subjects, such as Scheman draws attention to, that history is relevant to one's reasoning concerning the likelihood that the scientific institution can provide significant knowledge for them. If an institution thinks so little of a marginalized group that they are willing to commit ethical violations on them as research subjects, it would seem very unlikely indeed that they are capable of and or willing to produce and provide knowledge of particular significance for that group. In this way, my analysis of scientific institutions as providers of significant knowledge, coupled with a situated analysis of knowing and trustworthiness, helps clarify how the histories of ethical abuses can have direct relevance to reasonable assessments of the epistemic trustworthiness of such institutions. As Russell Hardin has noted, those who are disposed to distrust are likely to miss out on opportunities. And of relevance for this discussion, many of those will be opportunities to learn and acquire knowledge. If it is the case that certain marginalized groups have greater reason to distrust scientific institutions as providers of significant knowledge, then we have identified a specific form of epistemic injustice that has gone unnoticed, what I'm calling epistemic trust injustice. Members of marginalized groups who have greater reason to distrust do not have access to what they need to be able to exercise a responsible trust in these institutions. Yet responsible trust is required if they're able to have a epistemically grounded trust that can enable them to attain epistemic goods not available through other means. Given our deep dependence on scientific institutions for the provision of scientific knowledge, significant knowledge, sorry, the reduced opportunity for responsible trust that faces members of marginalized groups for which scientific institutions have poor histories is a pretty serious concern. Just returning to some of the language that Fricker used, she distinguishes between distributive injustice and discriminatory injustices. For her, testimonial and hermeneutical injustices are not simply distributive injustices, where some persons unfairly receive more epistemic goods, that is, have access to more knowledge than others. Fricker wants to make the point that testimonial and hermeneutical injustice cut to the core of what it is to be a knower and enable us to engage our epistemic agency. Given that the net result of epistemic trust injustice can be viewed as a situation of certain groups being unable to access particular bits of knowledge that can only be accessed through trust. So given that, we might think that epistemic trust injustice fits squarely within the category of distributive injustice. However, although it is the case that there is an unequal distribution of knowledge that might ensue, I actually say might because I haven't dealt with the excessive trust that might come from someone who's in a very privileged place, right? That needs to be dealt with as well. I hope my analysis suggests that there's more to epistemic trust injustice than just this distribution. I've argued not just that marginalized groups miss out on epistemic opportunities because they in fact distrust the institutions, but rather that in some cases they lack the track record and weight of evidence that would be necessary for a responsibly formed trust. If we take seriously a social epistemology that recognizes our capacities as knowers depends deeply on those outside of ourselves, then when there are structural features to our epistemic practices that prevent certain people from being able to exercise their epistemic agency in the required way, the epistemic injustice runs deeper, interfering with our capacities as socially embedded epistemic agents. So in close then, I'll just quickly return to our Inuit case and say a little bit more about it, where in fact there has been a long history of scientific research being done in the Arctic. There have been lots of cultural divides, lots of issues with the fact that often governmental policy then gets based on whatever the scientists have done up there, whether that be wildlife management or whether that be anthropology or whatever. There are lots of different social issues and social problems for the Inuit who live in the north. So we've got a very long history of reasons to wonder, not good communication and not a good history, not a good track record of being able to provide knowledge that Inuit can recognize as being significant for them. Lots of times, knowledge is taken and taken away, right? It's exacerbated in the Arctic because of the geographical isolation and the cultural isolation. So there's real practical problems, like short field seasons. Scientists going up, showing up for like a 3-week field season, disappearing again, right? And then if you want to have extra communication, very expensive to have another trip up or whatever. So there's all kinds of actual practical problems there on top of just general cultural issues and cultural divides. So I wanted to give this example again. How can we end up in these situations? And it's a bigger question to sort of look at what's the next step in terms of how are you going to try to correct for some of those problems. But I just want to illustrate this with a quote here from some researchers who have worked up there. In some parts of the Canadian Arctic, local Inuit refer to researchers as siksiks, ground squirrels, in Inuktitut. For many northern communities, researchers and siksiks seem to share similar characteristics. They appear suddenly, usually in the summer months, scurry around on the tundra, doing who knows what, and then disappear just as quickly, without anyone's knowing exactly what they were up to. Sometimes siksik is used in a friendly, joking manner. Other times, the nickname expresses negative feelings toward researchers, a mistrust that stems from a history of non-communication, miscommunication, and misunderstanding. And I guess I can close with just thinking, if this were your scientist, would you trust him? Thank you.
I just wanted to ask a question about whose interests are at stake, for instance, in the example you had. Because while you've laid out some compelling grounds for distrust folks might have in science, the question is whose long-term interests are really being threatened here? I mean, you could make the case that the distrust is understandable, but it's only going to redound in the long run against them.
Absolutely.
A parallel case I think of, last year I was in South Africa and heard a very chilling case where the president, which you probably already know, the president of South Africa after Mandela, who believed that HIV did not cause AIDS because he felt it was a plot by Big Pharma,
right.
And so said that it had to be treated with lemon juice and onions or lemon juice and garlic or something like that. Thousands of people died.
Right.
So while the hostility, the reaction that people might have against science, researchers might be understandable. Whose interest does that really hurt?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely everybody's. And some analysis would say that Inuit politicians are actually quite slick about this, right? And that they certainly recognize that they have, there's the micro issue of the polar bear population, there's the macro issue of what's happening to their environment, right? And there's lots of other evidence that they actually observe of global warming and the change that's happening. It's really dramatic there with change in permafrost and sea ice and everything, right? And so they do want to figure it out, but this is also, that just sort of expresses the seriousness of this and why it's really important to try to find ways of, it's really hard when you have long histories of distrust, not just long histories of distrust, but where there is some reason for it, right? And that's why it's a serious injustice, but everybody, you're right, their interests are right in there, yeah. And they know it.
Great talk. I actually want to push you from the opposite angle.
Okay.
Because as you were talking, and I think you said, that when you have epistemic trust injustice, these marginalized groups can't engage in responsible trust with these institutions. And it struck me of why not frame it from the other side, that this isn't a trust injustice, this is a trustworthiness injustice. And the problem isn't that the marginalized groups aren't trusting these institutions enough because of history. The problem is that the privileged groups are trusting them too much. Because
right.
None of this information should be, secret or subjective, right? So, why not frame it that way?
I actually have a paper that works on that. in the climate change issue, and looking at why is it that there's a higher rate of privileged white males who are climate change deniers, right? And what's behind that and that. Because I do think that is another issue, although that's one that you got to look carefully at in terms of figuring out where the pieces are, where the trust is excessive. And there are, of course, many cases where we do think that lots of us trust too much, right? Some of that may even depend on how aware you are of histories of environmental degradation and what sort of environmental regulations failures in certain respects. That's just one example, but yeah.
Thanks, that was really interesting. So this trust injustice is when background social marginalization means people aren't in a position to engage in normal assessments of trustworthiness. right?
Because it's when social marginalization plays out in the history of knowledge production, yeah. Right? Yeah.
So I agree. I was just wondering how optimistic or pessimistic, because that's a completely wholesale idea, this thing mm-hmm. of science. But presumably, is this right, that for any given community that mm-hmm. might be described in those terms?
You're talking about a layperson community or a scientific community?
For instance, the Inuit layperson,
okay, yeah.
who are indeed marginalized and have this
yeah.
trust in justice. They presumably just do trust, I don't know, doctors, they get medical, they trust mm-hmm. science here and there, right? Mm-hmm. So it's localized patches
good.
Where it's going to flare up and matter to them that they're not in a position
good.
To
excellent.
Judge. And so then, if it is, then it looks like there might be something that can be done about it, like more communication from the 6-6.
Right.
Because if it's
they don't actually mean it in a nasty way sometimes.
But if it's just a global problem, you think, wow, what can we do?
What can we do?
But if it's
yeah.
actually kind of flaring up in localized patches, then
right.
it looks like a scientific community might be able to do something.
Right. Excellent, excellent question. Or comment question. But here's what I think. I think it is very important to identify the particular context, because we can easily say, I trust science in this area, and I've got a few qualms about the, you know, whether you even, maybe it's because you think that this area of science is too commercialized, so there's too much interest in pharmaceuticals, and so you're not going to believe everything the pharmaceutical companies tell you, or something like that. You can easily have pockets like that. My worry with this epistemic trust injustice in that is that if you have very widely, a group that is very significantly and widely marginalized, then it becomes a case where it actually starts to make sense to let your trust travel from one context to another, and it might, and it doesn't in the Inuit. It doesn't become wholesale. It's not a blanket. Particularly, in part because there's been a lot of changes made so that you can't do scientific research out there without having an Inuit person involved in your research. That's now a requirement. And that, why did that happen? That's because they now have self-governance. Right, so they can insist, you want to do research up here? Here's what you got to do. You got to satisfy our requirements. And that. So there have been changes like that. But I do worry that trust does travel across contexts, and I don't think it's unreasonable for it to. I think sometimes it is unreasonable. You're reaching out too far because you're looking at all the different areas of evidence, and you may have some evidence that it's working pretty well for you here, right? Or it's been able to produce that, so it's useful in some ways. But where are the lines of the contest, and if that helps at all, but, yeah.
I just wanted to press you a little bit mm-hmm. on two different ways that the scientific community might be untrustworthy to the Inuits. So on the one hand, you have, you know, you can imagine a case where someone like Mengele conducts hypothermia experiments on living patients. So we don't want to trust Mengele's goodwill towards anyone, really.
Mm-hmm.
But his data is actually pretty good. And we might want to trust him about like when hypothermia sets in and how to treat it and things like
right.
that. So on the one hand, malice doesn't necessarily mean epistemic irresponsibility. Whereas on the other side, it seems like one thing that may be missing here is the Inuit may reasonably feel that they have a form of expertise that the scientific community is failing.
Right.
Because the scientific community, as far as it goes, has great expertise. But
mm-hmm.
it seems like it often does a lousy job of incorporating mm-hmm. the expertise of non-scientific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
this is more gap.
Right, yeah, and the Inuit example is really clear in that. I talked about short field seasons, and even in wildlife management, there are narwhal researchers for a long time thought some things about narwhals because they were only observing them in the summer, and they weren't bothering to ask what Inuit knew about the rest of the life cycle through. So there's where you get a really strong gap, again, because of that severe isolation, right, that feeds into it. So, yeah, your first part again was on the malice, right? That doesn't do enough. Yeah, I think part of the problem is that this is the significance of my shift to saying that what you're taking on when you're involved in an expert lay relationship is being a provider of significant knowledge. So there's a lot more than just your data involved in that, and it's also, I think, difficult in many cases for a layperson to separate out or identify, well, where's the good, what piece is the good part, and what can I throw out, right? particularly if, and you're also not going to be interested in that data unless it can actually be provided to you in a way that could be helpful or useful at some point or whatever. So I am aware it's a controversial position, but I am pushing on that a little bit, that it's not going to be quite so easy to just be dismissive and say, well, of course, you know, the Southern scientists here are right on this, but you're not going to trust the Canadian government to, they've won a little bit. Why is it special concern in Canada? Because of the pressure of the Inuit, that this is that this is too, you know, too much. For
Professor Graswick, I'd like to have you address an issue of distrust of the public, as I see it, in the context of environmental concern. We're environmentalists, we want to minimize fossil fuels, and particularly coal, and we refer to wind, solar, biofuels, da-da-da. Mm-hmm. Nobody mentions nuclear anymore. And I dare say within this room, when I say the word nuclear power, I think people might say, well, who's this, some kind of kook? And I've read some scientific reports that talk about the safety record of the nuclear power industry, the availability of fuel, the long-term efficiencies, newer designs now that are much, much safer. There's a lot of good reasons, it seems to me, why the scientific community should be communicating about that.
Right.
And so what's the resistance? And is this a case where there was a public distrust of I don't know if it's a public distrust of science or a public distrust of a technology that the public thinks they understand and yet maybe they don't really, or don't really understand what's happened in the last 50 years
to
of
develop it.
Nuclear
right.
technology.
Right, yeah. Well, one explanation for that might be that scientists are dependent on others for money. And so they have to play the political game to get money to do their research. And if it's not a popular area politically, they may feel like they're banging their head against the wall. Now, you're talking about those who are involved, who have done this research, why aren't they communicating more? Like those who have done the developments within nuclear energy, why aren't they out at the forefront?
Yeah, is there a resistance on the part of, let's say, the media to
I think that, yeah, they're
probably, right. Because they think that, I don't know, they're going to get hate mail or something.
Right, and things like Fukushima don't help, right?
Pardon?
things like the accident post-tsunami in Japan don't help.
No, oh, right. Definitely don't know. Yeah, no, right. No question about it. And you know, I mean, you get into the specifics of what technology was being used there and how, you know.
Right, it's,
what,
yeah.
Could this ever happen again in the next,
right.
you know, whatever.
Right.
And yet, I mean, I think there are lots of advances that could make, we don't seem to question so much nuclear-powered submarines, you know, or nuclear power in satellites and space stations and so forth. And yet, there are opportunities to use small-scale nuclear power plants or generators, even. You know, might be an important aspect of our energy future. So, I mean, to me, that's kind of an example of kind of distrust.
Right, and a distrust. We get certain cultural images of it that go with us and stay with us, right? Right.
Are there any other questions?
Yes, please.
Let's say you're also a scientist.
Right.
So like you know what goes on or whatever, you're very educated in science, I won't make you an expert in it. Would you be trusting wrongly if you do trust in an establishment? Is your trust in them not warranted because, let's say, you've been experimented on by them or, like, historically marginalized by them?
There I think you'd be in a much better position to contextualize, like going back to Miranda's question of how global is this, and you know, you'd be in a way you're this is not then a relationship of just completely outside and not understanding any not working with what that scientific community is up to. Certainly in your field or whatever, you have a different relationship to both the knowledge and a read on what the history means, right? So I think it's you will have a much more sort of nuanced thought about. Although, no, I wouldn't want to. It would depend on your history.
Any other questions? All right, let's thank our speaker again.